WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Okay, you want to level on me, or are you set? Great. Take this off. You grew up in a life of violence. That's really all you knew. When you were growing up, your mother was a prostitute and a gambler. Did she ever try to shield you from the work that she was doing or protect you from the kind of violence associated with prostitution and gambling?
Of course not, Terry. I was included in all of the activities in the house. As a matter of fact, when I was 4 years old, part of my job was to watch for the police, serve the whiskey and collect the money, and watch the dice game so that nobody would slip in some crooked dice if Emma happened to look off. So I was a part of the operation. I was Emma's right-hand man, so to speak, even when I was 4 years old.
Did you assume that to be an adult, that's what you did? You know, that when you're an adult, you gambled?
Well, crime was a way of life where I grew up. And all the idols, my idols, people that I wanted to be like, they were nothing but hustlers, gamblers, thugs, thieves, prostitutes, pimps, whatever. And I wanted to grow up and be just like Emma when I got to be a big boy.
Your father was a white man who was one of the tricks of your mother, and she had a lover who was black, and he left her when he saw that you were not his son.
That's right.
Did she treat you any differently knowing that you were part white and that you were the offspring of a trick and not of her lover?
Well, she and Mr. Albert, who was my white father, they had a relationship that I feel went a little bit deeper than being a trick. But she loved Blue, whose name my last name is Sample, and his name was Sample. She was legally married to Alan Sample. But in 1930... when he came in and saw me, he knew I wasn't his, like you said, and he walked out on her. That resulted in Emma blaming me when I got big enough to understand it, is that every time I get a man, every time I'm doing okay, you run them off. They take one look at you, and then there goes my man. So growing up with Emma was a constant day-to-day learning how to duck and dodge as well as doing the other things, because when she drank a little bit too much sometimes, she got very violent toward me. She could always look over in the corner and see me sitting over there and literally doing nothing. But I seemed to bring out the very worst in her. She had to blame somebody, and she certainly wasn't going to blame Emma. And she blamed me for every unhappy thing that ever happened in her life.
You were, what, 15 when you ran away?
I was 12.
12.
12 years old when I ran away the first time. Well, and I was just paying her back, Terry. You see, when I was 6 years old in 1936 in Longview, Texas, which was almost the headquarters for the Ku Klux Klan at that time, and Emma and her baby sister, the one that was born on the side of the road when Emma's father killed her mother, Elzada, they were had been tricking with white men for years. And Elzada had just had one that was living with her. And white people really got a little bit upset about that, and the Klan got involved, and they ran him out of town. Excuse me. And after Emma was gone for 6 years, 4 years, I beg your pardon, I was six when this happened, and I didn't see any more until I was 10. So there I was stuck in that town with nowhere to go, didn't have no friends. We hadn't been there that long in the town, and Emma was not a social person to begin with. The only social activities she participated in was either when she was tricking or gambling, and didn't that many people in town like her to begin with. So I either slept on the bridges, on the pool tables or whatever, and I really got angry with her for leaving me that like stuck like that. So after she came back, she started right where she left off, abusing me whenever she got to drinking too much. And when I was 12, she hit me one time, broke one of my teeth, and then I ran off. And I was gone a long time. I traveled all over the United States riding freight trains. I was in New York shining shoes in Grand Central Station, sleeping in Father Divine's temple with derelicts, drunks, thugs, dining-outers. And but it don't make no difference where I'd go. I'd miss her. I missed Emma. She was my buddy. And at times when she was okay, she was the best person in the world I'd want to be around. She was so different. She could make a dog laugh. She had a tremendous sense of humor. And she was so cunning. And it was hard to stay away from her. Even though I ran away, she was always on my mind wherever I was.
Was it hard to make a living and find a place to sleep, to get enough money for food when you were so young and on your own on the road?
Yes, I did a whole lot of eating in the hobo jungles. That's sort of a code among those individuals that they'll share. If they got a big black pot of coffee, you're welcome to a cup. If there's three cans of beans, you can share in one. And I learned how to steal and how to hustle and how to pick pockets and how to gamble. Well, I already knew how to gamble. I've been gambling ever since I was 4 years old. And just from hustle to hustle, I was able to survive. That's all I knew how to do. And at that age, working was out of the question. So it was just a matter of what I could scuffle up on. And I did pretty good. I made it okay.
What were the charges that landed you in prison in Texas?
Armed robbery by assault, and I had several cases of armed robbery. And for one of these offenses, I was sentenced to 20 years. And ironically, I had gone to this burning hell, the retrieve unit, where they assigned me, and I had served a year and 3 or 4 months on that 20-year sentence. And then they came and got me, bench warranted me out, and took me to another town in another county, and I received a 30-year sentence, which nullified the 20. So when I went back from court that time, I started all over again on a brand new 30-year sentence and had lost all of the time that I had already spent. So I started off all over again on 30 years.
You really describe it as being one of the worst, most brutal and sadistic prisons in Texas, perhaps, in the country. What made this prison even worse than others? What made it different?
Well, I guess it's where it's located, for one thing, and the kinds of people that they have running it. Most of the officers that we had at the retrieve unit, again, I say it was known more commonly as the burning hell, I'd be willing to venture that 90% of the officers couldn't even read and write. They were illiterates. And here we were, 90% of us were the same way. We were illiterate. So look at what you've got together here. And most of the officers that work the prison systems live within a 5 or 10 mile radius of those prisons. They spent their whole lives around them. Their dreams, their big hopes was to grow up someday and be a guard like Dad. The mentality that was in charge is what I feel made it one of the worst. Plus, we had the worst convicts all housed at this particular unit. They made that prison up with the worst of all the other prisoners throughout the prison system. And we had 14 prison units scattered off all over South Texas. So they picked the worst from all of these, and then they made up the retrieve unit from that batch.
The prison was segregated, so all the prisoners were black, but all the guards were white.
Every one of them.
Did that, do you think, bring out a certain sadism in the guards?
I don't doubt it, not one bit. Not one bit. It was a lot of situations where it provided so much opportunity for the guards to be in charge of a bunch of blacks and be able to, he had somebody right there that he could vent all of his angers, he could take out all of his frustrations, etc., on these convicts, because they literally held the power of life and death over every man that was in the squad. And it didn't take a whole lot to get killed. Certain cases like homosexuality and things like that, homosexual activities, were viewed as minor things, minor infractions in the prison system. But if you say, if you tell a guard that you're not going to do something, or if you, quote, sass him out, you might get put in solitary and they put the key around a jackrabbit's neck and turn him loose. You may never get out. Those are the offenses that they really take issue with, as being impudent, as they call it. Don't you be no impudent darky here.
When you first got into the prison, and as you said, these were the prisoners considered to be the worst in the whole chain of prisons in South Texas, what did you have to do to prove yourself so that you wouldn't be eaten up alive by the other prisoners?
If you won't fight, you were going to be sucked up. There's no doubt about it. And I guess that's one of the things that I can look back and appreciate, if you will, Emma's training of me. The boot camp that I went through with Emma prepared me very eloquently for my stay in prison. I was incorrigible when I got there. A lot of the convicts that were in prison with me had to have been treated so badly for so long before they became, quote, incorrigibles. I was an incorrigible the day that I walked through the front gate. And I walked through there ready to do that 30-year sentence any way I had to do it, and it didn't make no difference if I had to end up with another 100 while I was there. I wasn't going to be no yowza yowza, and I wasn't going to snitch on nobody, and wasn't nobody going to just do me any kind of way without me responding to that in a very quick and positive and decisive way as quickly as I could. So fighting was a common thing in the prison system, and it was a place where if somebody said to you, "Man, I'm going to get you tonight," your best shot is to kill him right then, because he meant that. If you expect to wake up in the morning, then you better get rid of him now. And that's tragic, to operate a prison where that even the prisoners themselves are not safe from each other. Now, how can you expect that individual to come out here and function and feel safe, so to speak, and he's out here where he can get his hand on a weapon or whatever, and this has been common practice. This is the way he has survived for all of those years that he's in there. And if nothing is done to change that, then look at the danger. Look at how tragic that is to take a person and keep him someplace for 10, 15 years, and then when you see him again, he's worse than he was before we ever said hello to him. And that, to me, don't make sense.
What were some of the typical challenges that were made to you when you first got to the prison?
The first night, I'll never forget that, Terry. The first night that I got to the prison system, they assigned me to, the first day, they assigned me to the number 3 tank. And when I walked in a tank after the building tender in Texas, at that time they were using other convicts to act in lieu of guards. And they were allowed to have crude homemade knives, pieces of chain hanging off their belts, and had the authority to kill, maim, cripple, or whatever at the slightest insistence by a guard. All a lieutenant had to do was say, "Kill that nigga," and you were dead meat if you didn't win. And this particular night, after we came in from the work, I didn't make it to my tank that first night. After the first day's work, the old guard that I was working under, his name was Boss Deadeye, and he had me cut out that afternoon at the back gate, And I spent the first night in that prison hanging up on the handcuffs, strapped to the bars with my toes just touching the floor. And his reason for cutting me out and having me punished was that I spent the whole afternoon in the fields counting birds. He said I didn't do a lick of work. He said all I did was stood out there and count birds. Now, the next night after I worked that day, when I went in the tank that night to lay down, I got off my bunk, and you don't get off your bunk. You don't go use the latrine or nothing like that until you holler, "Alley boss," and then you wait for a response. And on my way down the alley, one of the convicts went, you know, like that. And I stopped immediately. And I looked him right in his eyes, and I said, "What you got on your mind, man?" And he said, "What's it to you?" I didn't say nothing else. I walked on. He whistled again. And in the back of the tank, there was 8 commodes with those old-timey tops that when you get up off of the seat, it flushes itself. And a couple of them were broken. The seat parts were just barely hanging there. So I went on back to the latrine area, and I got me a half one of them commode seats. And when I went back up through the alley, I lit in on him. And because I knew that my future on that tank was at stake. Now, if I didn't challenge and if I didn't respond to that, then your life was going to be a miserable hell in that tank if you didn't take action right then. So after that, nobody whistled at me no more. You know, nobody said nothing either.
Once you established yourself as being strong enough to defend yourself and unwilling to take challenges like that from other inmates, did you advance the same kind of challenges against toward the new inmates who came in?
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. I have never participated in no kind of activity like that in my life. Simply because you go to prison, just because you go to prison, that does not mean that you can't still be a human being within your own self. You don't have to become a dog just because they put you work at a kennel. You don't have to be an animal because you're walking through the jungle. And I was dead set and determined that I was a man when I went in there, and I was going to be one when I came out, or I wasn't going to make it out. I mean, when it came to that kind of thing, I just don't have that in me. I don't have that kind of thinking about things like that. I had seen, God, I'd been abused all my life. Why would I want to do that to some other guy? For example, they did a little dumpling when they sent him to the penitentiary. Here was a guy, 21 years old, who they inadvertently sent to that burning hell with all incorrigible prisoners, and he was a first-time offender, and then put him on the tank with us. It was just like throwing a piece of liver in there to 15 alley cats. And it was just a matter of seconds before old Bull had him under his wing and went to abusing him, and the poor kid eventually wind up doing his 2-year sentence day by day because he cut old Blue up, old Bull up pretty bad, and the warden decided that he'd have to stay there his whole 2 years. But I've seen that happen not only to 21-year-olds and somebody that they made a mistake in the classification committee and sent to that unit. Those old buzzards that had been in that prison a long time, that was the only life they knew. Perfectly content. Seemed like they had just completely washed themselves free of humanness in any way, and they were more inclined to act like, quote, animals than humans. And I just couldn't give that up.
I'm speaking with Albert Ray Sample, and he's written a memoir about his life, including his years in prison and then his life afterwards, and the book is called Racehorse, Big Emma's Boy. You mentioned that it's like right after you got to prison, really, that you were that one of the bosses said that you hadn't worked all day, you were just counting birds, which wasn't true.
Of course not.
And for punishment, he hung you up, and this was a common punishment at the prison.
That's right.
He hung you up by the cuffs. Why don't you explain how that punishment worked?
Okay. The bars in the hallway that separated the mess hall from the tanks, they were constructed just the right height to where when they put your hand, put a cuff on one hand and loop your arm through the bars in this fashion, and then put the other one back over your head that way and clamp the other one on. This bar that's going this way, I'm 5'8", and it caused me to have to, I would be just barely touching the floor. It wasn't as hard if a person, the taller you were, the better off you were. But I was had to hang from the weight of my wrist, and these cuffs, they put them on just as tight as they can get them to where after a few moments, your fingers get stiff and numb because the circulation of blood just seemed like it stops right at that point, and it feels like somebody's stabbing in the wrist with a ice pick.
So it's like being crucified.
Oh, you bet.
Through handcuffs.
Absolutely.
To the bars of a cell.
How beautiful a word. That is just exactly, that's a beautiful word for that.
Yeah. And how many hours would you be hung up?
There was no telling.
Uh-huh.
It was just, it would depend on when Big Devil, the warden, decided he wanted to let you down. If he went deer hunting or something, and he loved to do that, you didn't get out until he come back.
And if you, of course, they wouldn't release you to go to the bathroom or anything.
Oh, no. Every time you wet your pants when you're hanging up there, that costs you another hour on those cuffs. And as soon as they took them off your wrist, you had about 5 minutes to get ready to go to work, because they turn you loose about 5:15 in the morning, just enough time to give you a chance to go get a drink of water in the tank and maybe take a leak, and you got to catch your squad.
Was this an invention at this particular jail, or do you think that this was practiced at a lot of prisons?
It was common practice at all the black units, and they had three at that time. They had Retrieve, excuse me, and Clemens, and Ramsey. And on those three units, they were Clemens was all-black unit for first offenders, and Retrieve was the all-black unit for the multi-recidivists, the incorrigibles, and Ramsey was for the blacks that was somewhere in between. And all of those units used cuffs as part of the punishment, which is the most severe of all the punishments. Solitary, I'd take it any day as opposed to being strung up on the bars on the cuffs.
Is that still used as a punishment?
They banished them for use like that. But every time that, say, if you were working in the fields and you had a disciplinary problem with your immediate guard out there, for them to get you to the building, they're going to cuff you and throw you in the back of the pickup truck and take you to the building. Now, they'll take them off when you get there and put you in solitary. But I have seen them use cuffs to handcuff men to the bumpers of pickup trucks and drag them through the fields as a spectacle for the other men to see.
Now, there are a couple of different kinds of work that you had to do, because this was mm-hmm. also a work prison.
You bet. It was a plantation.
Yeah. Do you want to describe the
yeah,
kind of work
14,600 acres under cultivation. There was 425 men on that camp. But when you take away those individuals who had, quote, jobs, turnkeys, building tenders, cooks, flunkies, and things like that, we ended up with only about 200 men working in the squads, tilling the soil. So we chopped cotton, we picked cotton, we stripped cane, we cut logs, we cleared bottom land. We did all the agriculture work. And a plantation of that size, you can imagine, just figure out how many acres is that per man. You see, and cotton was a main product. And if you was a good cotton picker, you could make it. If you couldn't pick cotton, you might wind up being literally starved to death because your eating is based on your weight. The cotton you pick, if you don't pick enough, as they put it, then you don't eat. And you're still going to hang up on the cuffs or they put you in solitary. And as soon as they let you down, you're going right back out there and try it all over again. And it's phenomenal how them missing all those meals can speed up your hand speed. You'll eventually learn how to pick cotton or you're going to starve to death. I mean, there ain't no other alternative. That's it. You're going to do it or die. That's it.
Well, you got your nickname, Racehorse, from being so good at
chopping
hoeing
cotton.
Yeah. And you became the pace setter for the group.
That's right, the lead role man, we called it.
That seemed to me like a difficult position to be in because...
It is.
Yeah, because you have to be really fast and that forces
That's
everybody
right.
else to work faster. And if you're not really fast, you're just going to get punished.
That's
so
right.
It doesn't seem to be any way you can win.
There's no... it's a no-win situation. So it's left up to you as the lead role person, if they've made you that, put you on that number one role to set the pace for the entire work squad, plus sing the songs, the river songs, to keep the beat, the cadence, and all this stuff. And if somebody challenges you for that position by pulling up ahead of you, it's telling the boss that he ain't working fast enough to suit me, and I'm going to push him to make him go faster. Well, now the boss will clear the both of you to go ahead and race now, and whichever one of you burns the other out, then he's the new guy. You know, he's the new kid on the block. So I had really learned how to weck, as they put it. They used to say a lot of time, them niggas don't know how to weck at all. But I learned how to weck under the boss band. And I could chop a cotton roach so pretty till it almost make you want to cry, you know. And I learned that for survival's sake. I mean, there was no choice. Either you going to do it this way or he'd shoot you. And me and this old railhead shorty was racing one day, chopping cotton. And after I beat him, I remember boss band called me back and he told me, he said, I was watching you niggas race horsing up and down them roads a while ago. He said, I ain't never seen a nigga clean a road like that before. Where'd you learn how to chop cotton like that at? I said, right here in the penitentiary, boss. He said, well, I tell you what. He said, from now on, that's what I'm going to call you, old race horse. He said, when I call you that nigga, you better answer me. You hear me? And I said, oh, Lord, which was customary. If you didn't say, oh, Lord, before you spoke to him or addressed him, he would kill you. And he told us that the day he took over that squad, that if any one of you sputes my word, I'm going to kill you. If any one of you niggas don't do exactly like I tell you, I'm going to kill you. If any one of you niggas lay the hammer down, which means quitting, under me, I'm going to kill you. And it leaves you to wonder, is it nothing he won't kill us for, you know? And that's the kind of man he was. And he would kill you. There's no doubt about it.
And this was the meanest, toughest of all the bosses who you had to work
under. He was
imported
from another unit up north, the Eastern Farm, to specifically come to the Bun in Hell to carry my work crew.
Were there ever any mutinies when you were there?
Oh,
or
yes.
Prison revolts?
Yes. Matter of fact, I led one time in the cane fields. We were stripping cane, and that's a real hard work. It cuts you all up, you know, especially when the leaves are wet and you're stripping from the top all the way down to the trunk of that stalk of cane, excuse me, and my hands had just been cut to ribbons. That's some of the scars. You can still see them there today. And I just stopped and I showed my hands to my boss and I told him, I said, man, I ain't quitting because I don't want to work. I said, I know I got to work. That's why I'm out here. And I ain't quitting for that. I said, but I can't do it if I can't touch them. Every time I grab the stalk, I just slice my hands to ribbons. And not only my hands, everybody's hands were that same way. And I just sat down and told him I wasn't going to do it no more. And when I did that, everybody in my squad stopped. They sat down too. And then all across the field, one squad after another, they laid the hammer down too. They quit. And Big Devil, the warden, came out there after the cry went out that them niggas done bucked. And they brought all the cattle prods and stuff like that out there and started shocking us with them and things to try to make us go back to work, but nobody would. And for the first time since I had been in that prison all those years, the first time that I had ever heard tell of a official, quote, taking sides with the convicts, and they sent up to Huntsville when the word reached the main administration building, which was about 200 miles from where I was assigned. He came down in his airplane, and after he asked several times why you don't want to go back to work, well, everybody in the squad went to looking at me because, after all, I was the lead role man, and I just got up and went up to the trailer he was standing on, and I showed him my hands. And it really surprised me that everybody in the field was together for one time. That was the only time I ever saw every man in the field stick together. Everybody held up their hands, and God, they were all looking bloody and just cut all to pieces. And he made a decision right then, take the men out of the field. Don't put them back out here until you can get them some gloves to do this kind of work with, and take them in there and bathe them and give them some good supper. And after that, we started, that was the very day that we started being able to, allowed to use the trailers to ride that 5-6 miles every day that we ran backwards and forwards from breakfast and lunch and supper. We started riding to the fields on the trailers after that particular incident.
It's interesting, too, that the protest that you led was a peaceful one.
Yeah.
It was like a sit-down strike.
Yeah, that's all it was. And nobody was quitting because we didn't want to work. Because Retrieve, the Burning Hell, was famous for work. Everybody there was a high roller, so to speak. But under the conditions, you can't work if you can't put your hands on what you're trying to work with. And especially, and we were getting them cut every time you touch it. You had a new cut. Every time you stripped a stalk, your hands were cut again. And that's, you just can't do it that way.
What about prison escapes? Were there regular attempted escapes?
At Retrieve, there were a lot of attempts, but it was famous for not letting them get out the bottoms. One of the most difficult things about escaping from Retrieve was just because of where it was located. It's very near the Gulf of Mexico, on the southeast side of Texas, swampland, bottomland. If you run 10 miles this way, you're in the Gulf of Mexico, and if you run 15 miles to the east, you're going to end up on another prison camp. And if you go north, there's another prison camp there. So a lot of people that ran away and escaped, they were caught 10, 15 miles away just on another unit because there was so many of them situated in that particular area.
You always wonder why people try to escape when the odds are so much against them.
Sometimes the pressure can be so heavy. Sometimes things can be going so bad, Terry, until I've seen guys just jump up off a row and just run out across the field hoping somebody would kill him just to get it over with. I remember many times in my prison career that I felt just exactly like throwing up both of my hands and just demanding that somebody shoot me right between the eyes. It got that heavy a lot of times. So a lot of times guys didn't run off just to get away. They were hoping they would get killed.
You actually got out in 72. You were paroled in 72,
yes,
right?
Yes, 1972.
But you ended up back in prison shortly there.
No, not after. 72 was the last time.
Oh, okay.
I got paroled in like 69 or 70 or something like that. No, it was 65 I got out, and I stayed out about 18 months, and I was back.
Well, what happened to you happens to a lot of people.
Sure.
Who've spent most of their adult lives in prison. They get out, and before you know it, they're back again.
Hey, I was a professional convict. I knew how to do time in prison because I had been well-trained and disciplined as a convict. I knew how to do time. I wasn't scared of picking cotton. Hey, I was a cotton-picking champion. So that held no more fear for me. I was scared to death out here. I didn't know nothing in the world to do. They wasn't hiring no cotton pickers and no pea shuckers and stuff like that. And getting a job was very difficult at that time. And having not been around people for so long, I was deathly afraid, nervous, uptight, and always feeling like somebody was watching me or somebody wanted to do something to me or jump on me or something, just like I had been in the prison system. So it didn't take very much to antagonize me enough to violate my parole for aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, and I was right back doing the rest of that 30-year sentence.
What did you think about when you were back? After you'd finally gotten out, and then a year later you're back again. What went through your mind when you returned?
I'm telling you, when I walked through that back gate, Terry, for that second time, the second time around at the Burning Hell, I felt like I was just about as big as a molecule. I wished I could have run to the edge of the earth and jumped off. I felt that badly about it. But I didn't have no choice but to get back in the harness again and start pulling and try to get out again someday, maybe, if I didn't die there.
How do other prisoners react to it when you come back?
They just love to hear you tell the stories of what happened while you were out, and everybody. It's amazing how the mind works with us at that time. Guy can got out of penitentiary and ain't been out but 20 days, you know. And when he comes back, he tells all these big stories about all the women he had and 16 Cadillacs and 19 Rolex wristwatches, and had a house up on the highest hill in the city and two pockets full of money at all times. And he's the same guy that as soon as you light up a cigarette, he asks you to save him his short, you know, save him his draw for that cigarette. Now, if you had all them women hustling for you and everything out there, how come nobody don't send you a pencil or stamp to write home or a package of cigarettes? So you wasn't doing too good out there, but they love to hear him tell those stories.
It was during that second round in Retrieve that you had your revelation and that you also, I think, started writing.
Yes.
During that
That's
second
true.
Round. Let's start with the writing. What made you start to write?
After the experience I had in solitary confinement.
Let's start with the solitary
and
confinement experience then. Why don't we
okay.
do that?
After that, I think, well, I know.
What happened?
A certain awareness came over me that I, for the first time, I began to realize really and truly like writing with a ever sharp pen, I could see the fine lines. You know, I realized where I was, what was going on, began to feel ashamed, began to feel like, geez, what am I doing?
Did you have a vision when you were in solitary?
Yes, I did. I certainly did. Terry, I had been in solitary a whole lot of times before this happened. And I wasn't scared of the dark and the boogeyman and stuff like that. I was a hardened criminal. And solitary, I had no fear of that. So it wasn't the fear of going in that it caused to happen what happened. I was sitting on a concrete slab in this 4x8 cell, which is pitch black dark. There's no face basin, no commode, only a small hole in the center of the floor that you do all your waste in. And I felt like I was right at the end of my row, so to speak. I felt so like it was over. I couldn't fight no more. They had got me. You won. That's exactly the way I feel. I was ready to give it up. And there's one thing about miracles, if you want to call one something a miracle, is there ain't never nobody there to see it but you. If you were walking on a dark street and you saw a flying saucer, they just look around. I bet you're the only person out there, and it's so difficult to try to explain that to someone afterwards. But I was sitting there buck naked, just like I come in the world, and I cried for the first time in many, 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 many years. Had tears had become foreign. You don't cry in prison. That's a sign of weakness, you know. And I was crying, and them tears was bouncing off of the floor on my feet. And I sat there in that moment of desperation, and I hid my face with my hand. I don't know why I hid my face in the dark. Could nobody see it anyway? And I hid my face, and I cried out. I said, God, help me. Help me. And just as soon as the words got off of my lips, I could see light between my fingers. I had my face hid that way, and I could see the light, and I began to wonder, how did the light get in here? Because there ain't no outlets. There's no bulbs. There's no lights possible. And it was just so soothing. It was calming. I didn't see nobody, but I knew that there was something inside of that cell with me. I knew it. And I could feel it. All throughout me, I could feel it. And I never felt so good in all my life. I felt just great, just beautiful, just wonderful. I felt like something cared about me, and I don't know why I was feeling that way, but I did. I laid back down on my slab, and I put my hands under my head, and this voice said to me, don't you worry about a thing, but you must tell them about me. And I didn't hate nothing. I didn't hate Emma no more. I didn't blame her for the way my life had turned around how my life had gone. I loved her again. And when I got out of there 28 days later, they weigh you when they put you in. I weighed 142 pounds when they put me in. When they took me out, I weighed 147, and the guard accused me that somebody had been slipping me food in there. Because the diet is half a cup of water and a half a biscuit a day for 6 days. On the seventh day, you get a square meal. And it's highly unlikely that you're going to gain weight with a diet that restrictive. And I know how I felt when I walked out of there after 28 days, when I reentered my tank back with the population, that I just knew that I was going to rush in there and tell everybody what had happened. You know, hey, a voice spoke to me. Something come to me when I was in solitary this time. But I knew that if I had have done that, they would have said, hey, they got him. Well, right. Race is done cracked. You know, they drove him down. Or they might have sent me to the funny farm. So I never said a word about that to anybody. The first person that I ever said that to was the warden, Big Devil. In 1974, 2 years after I was released, I had an opportunity to go and visit with him because I was working with some convicts that were being released at Huntsville, which was only about 20 miles from where he lived. I inadvertently got on the wrong road, and I ended up right in front of his dadgum house. And I went in there, and we sat out on the swing, and I was... After we talked about old times, and he remembered all the old convicts, and he was asking me about, have you seen this, and you seen old Doc Cat Eye and old Slocum Bill and all these people. And after we got through going over the directory of yesteryear, I says, Warden, I said, do you remember that time when you put me in solitary when Mr. Meebs run me in? I said, you know I hadn't done nothing to be put in there for. He says, yep. I said, well, God came to me that time while I was in there. I said, and I just wanted to tell you that. He says, well, I'm sure glad I had something to do with helping get your heart right, old racehorse. I says, that's where you're wrong, Warden. I said, you didn't have shit to do with it. And sip my lemonade. And from that point on, my life has never been the same. Never been the same.
You know, this raises something that I find really interesting. The state of Texas has, in a way, really embraced you since your pardon, because you've worked for the Texas Board of Corrections. You've gotten all these awards from very, very important and prestigious places in Texas. And I wonder if the Texas corrections system doesn't see you as a success story of theirs, because, after all, you emerged from this Texas prison as a reformed person, you know. Are they claiming you as a success story, and how are you playing
it? Not as a result of my stays in prison. I think that they respect my efforts since I've been out. They respect what I've tried to do with my work with other ex-offenders. I think they understand that I understand what can cause a person to be like I was for so many years. And I'm not saying that some miracle like that's going to happen in everybody's life, but I don't hesitate to tell nobody, you can't quit. You cannot quit. You can't give up the ship. You can't stop living. You've got to put as much effort on functioning out here as you did functioning well in the prison system. And I will tell them that, and these convicts know, hey, man, that dude knows what he's talking about. You know, you got to work while you're out here. You got to reestablish yourself in the community. And I think the successes that I've had in that field, at working with ex-offenders, being honest with them and open, I think they respect me a lot for that. And they take claim me for that effort more so than whatever happened to me in Texas prisons.
So you see, like, your own experience and awakening, your own vision in prison is not being a result of the great reform that a prison is capable of. You just see that as some kind of miracle that happened in spite of the prison system, not because of the prison system.
That's exactly the way I feel about it. Yes, ma'am.
When you got your parole and your pardon and you were out, Did you have any of the same problems that you had that first time when you were out for a year and you didn't really know how to behave outside of prison because you'd spent most of your adult life in it and you ended up in prison again a year after? Did you have any of those problems adjusting when you got out in the 70s?
Not one. It was unbelievably delicious. And nothing had ever been that way for me. And it was hard to understand that today I was a porter, tomorrow I was a general manager, today I'm working in the governor's office, and now I'm working in the State Bar of Texas. Here I am, a probation officer. Me? Racehorse? Me? Representing the governor's office? Me? Unbelievably delicious. And I was so happy that I had that opportunity to work with some people like me who had sort of come out on the short end of the stick, who had found it so difficult to find a way out when the door was right there, who'd been walking around in circles just like me. And I don't cut no slack when I'm talking to my groups and things when I work with them. I tell them just straight out like it is. You keep going like you're going, man, you're going to wind up becoming a part of cement mix and bricks and mortar. I says, now, if that's what you want to do with your life, if you want to lose all the self-respect you got, if you want your family to almost disintegrate because you're not there, if you want to give up all of these things and follow that and go down in that penitentiary and then come out three times worse than you were when you went in there, just keep on playing the game you're playing, and you just bought you a ticket. See, people don't get sent to prison. You buy the ticket, they just furnish the transportation.
Are you recommending any reforms to the state of Texas?
Yes, ma'am, I sure have. Oh, I work very closely with a lot of correctional people in the prison system. They ask me a lot of assistance in a lot of ways, and I work with a lot of judges in very difficult cases when they get somebody that they really don't want to send them to the penitentiary, but they know that they need some shocking. A lot of the judges will call old Race and say, well, I'm gonna let you hang around with that guy for a couple of weeks, and then you come back up here, and then we'll see about it.
So when you got out of prison, you really were a changed person. Your life had changed.
No doubt about it.
But were there any temptations for you, or were there any people who would intentionally try to tempt you, even to see if this whole change was maybe an act? You know, was there anybody who pulled that on you?
No, ma'am. Never did. I met a beautiful woman, a lovely lady that I married. We're still together to this day. I've got a 14-year-old daughter. I've never been nowhere, never worked nowhere since I've been out that I can't go back, because I made it a purpose that I would never close the door on my way out, because for an ex-offender to be able to get his foot in the door in the governor's office or the State Bar of Texas and the probation department, well, I would have been an idiot to mess that up. They would have never took a chance on another one as long as they lived. So I made very sure that whenever I changed jobs or whenever I was working on one, that whomever I was working for or with couldn't say but one thing, is he's a hard, hard worker and a good man, and we're going to miss him. And so that left the door open for some other ex-convict who may go by there and ask for a chance, and they could look back and say, well, we had one time, and he did us a good job. Let's give another one a chance. And if that happens, well, then it was worth all of it, the hard work and the effort.
You're basically writing now full time. You have another book in the works.
Yes.
For the first few years, you work very closely with the prison system, and although you were out of prison, you still had a kind of daily contact with prison. How do you feel now that you're writing? I guess you're doing most of your writing at home or in an office, and you don't have that daily contact with the prison world. Has that been good for you?
Well, I'm always available, Terry. Like I said a few minutes ago, the judges use me a lot, the DA, the probation department even, the parole board even, when they get difficult cases or somebody that they find it very difficult to place on a job or whatever, they'll give me a call, and I'll go and talk with the prospective employee. I'll talk with the convict that's trying to get it, the job, and then I can go back to that individual, and I can say, Mr. So-and-so, I almost can give you my word that that guy will make you a good hand. Because I know bullshit from Shinola. Ain't no need of telling me all this crap about, man, what I'm going to do. I done heard that all my life. I know crapola when I hear it, you know. And the other thing that helps me in my presentation is that just the facts that come built in with an ex-offender. If he's released on parole in Texas and you hire him as an his employer, number one, you ain't got to worry about his attendance. If he don't show up at work, all you got to do is call his parole officer, and he can be sent back to prison. If he don't perform well on a job, you ain't got to do but call him. So he comes to you with a heavy stick over his head to begin with. So the potential of this person blowing it is a lot less likely than for somebody else. He's no higher risk than any other person that you would hire. Matter of fact, he's less risky because he has somebody holding him in the seat of his britches. And I don't hesitate to tell people like that, and I don't say go round up all the ex-convicts in the world and put them to work. Those that are deserving, those who are willing to give it their best shot, those who want to work and reestablish themselves in this community, I feel like they should be given a shot. Because if you don't, you're just going to have to pay him in another way. You're going to have to pay for his keep somewhere else as opposed to letting him earn a living out here and support his own self.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your extraordinary story with us. And
thank you
very much for being here.
Thank you, Terry. It was a pleasure to meet you and to be on your program.